make mention that our respondent to today's paper is Jonathan Larson. John graduated from BYU with a BA in political science. He then went to Hastings. He is now an attorney practicing in San Francisco. He lives in Alameda with his wife and two children, where he is currently the Elders Quorum president. He has had, for quite a while, a special interest in church history, and so we're pleased to have him here today. Now, this afternoon...
Especially since
he was very good. This afternoon, it is our special privilege to hear from Leo Lyman, who will be presenting his paper on the alienation of the Mormons from other California citizens in the mid-1850s. Dr. Lyman has lived in California for 28 years. In fact, he served a mission here in California. He spent years of research in church history, on church history, and published dozens of articles in various magazines, including Dialogue. He's written a book, you're probably familiar with it, Political Deliverance, The Mormon Quest for Utah Statehood. He has another book, which will be published by Signature Press this summer, in fact, in June, so you don't have to wait very long for that one. And this one is entitled The Rise and Demise of a California Community, Mormon San Bernardino. Dr. Lyman is well-versed in Mormon-California connections. He has presented papers at Salt Lake and California Sunstone Symposium, and I think you'll very much enjoy his paper today. So without further ado, Dr. Lyman.
Thank you, Janet. That's very kind.
Members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints played a prominent role in the early Anglo-American history of California and enjoyed a position of high esteem in which they were held by their fellow citizens. Not only had Sam Brannan's associates on the ship Brooklyn done much to build the first city of San Francisco, but Mormon battalion soldiers had performed important service securing Southern California for the United States. Similarly, the role of the Brooklyn Saints establishing the agricultural community at New Hope in the San Joaquin Valley, and the former battalion veterans in the actual discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill were well known and appreciated. A greater influx of gold-seeking Mormons into California over the ensuing decade did nothing to alter the uniformly positive image and esteem in which they were held there. But at the end of the 10 years of Latter-day Saint involvement in the Golden State, public sentiment toward the church and its members changed rather abruptly. This paper seeks to trace the developments which brought this about. Church members gravitating to the gold fields in such numbers as to alarm their leaders in Utah and the San Bernardino colony was established at least partly to assist in retrieving some of these people so far as church activity was concerned. In this, they were quite successful. In the early 1850s, there were branches of practicing Mormons meeting regularly at San Francisco, San Jose, and several Sacramento area mining camps, most notably Mormon Bar and Salmon Falls, as well as more isolated families spread throughout the motherlode country who maintained religious observances as best they could. All of these were under the ecclesiastical jurisdiction of Amos M. Lyman and Charles C. Rich, the apostles who were the head of the San Bernardino colony, and as they would visit around the state, they would encourage the saints to gather either to Utah or to San Bernardino, and they had great success in gathering those people. As early as 1854, a correspondent of the San Francisco Daily Alta California commented, "In no portion of the state is there a more busy or thriving settlement, or one which in proportion to number is working more effectively than San Bernardino." The article cited a promise by the citizens there that, quote, "San Bernardino shall be the most beautiful city in California," end quote, and predicted, "To judge by their beginnings and what they've done elsewhere, their promise will be kept." The Alta also commented that in the Golden State, the Mormons were generally regarded as good neighbors and considered as upright and moral as other citizens. Tying the church firmly to earlier history of the state, the article recalled without much accuracy that it was Mormons who were the first farmers, the first millionaire, Sam Brannan, who had been kicked out of the church by that time, and the discoverer of gold, which isn't quite true, but was good positive public relations. The newspaper commented that little had been said in the state about plural marriage, observing that the Latter-day Saints had probably not introduced the practice in California for the sake of peace. The article concluded by affirming that California was fortunately free from the prejudice and hate against Mormons which prevailed in the Mississippi Valley, and further expressed hope that such would continue to be the case. This was demonstrative of the widely pervasive goodwill toward the California church members, not only at this time, but for several more years. Unfortunately, a small group of Mormons disaffected because of San Bernardino politics being dominated by church leaders, and those same leaders controlling most of the good land of the surrounding valley, concluded the most effective way to better their own position in both regards was to generate, if possible, a more negative image of the San Bernardino and California Latter-day Saints. In their first efforts, this faction, self-named the Rachabites, were entirely unsuccessful. This was mainly in 1856 during some attempts to generate a political opposition in San Bernardino. One of these leaders, who had been in San Francisco before, his name was Quartus S. Sparks. He was an articulate speaker. He was a lawyer. Not a very good pamphleteer. In fact, the pamphlet he and some of his associates wrote, trying to persuade California citizens that the Mormons hadn't very long been members of the dominant Democratic Party, was a kind of a flop. Mormon observers quietly chuckled at reports of their opponents' antagonistic statements not being met with success in Los Angeles, where they were called liars since a little more than a year previously they'd been missionaries there trying to proselytize for the church. The branch historian noted the anti-Mormons were convinced that their vile tales were not credited outside, and that had a tendency to cool off their ardor. Perhaps the most significant failure in the entire anti-Mormon effort in 1856 was the attempt to link their own presumed Reform crusade to the larger vigilante movement, largest one ever in San Francisco. The San Bernardino Independents had appealed for support to the newspapers of the state and state elected officials, but the group from which they most desired recognition was the Vigilance Committee, then virtually ruling the Bay Area. In this, they were entirely rebuffed. The reason, as Charles C. Rich said at the time, was, quote, "there was an excellent feeling among the influential men of the state toward the Mormon people," end quote. And the local opponents simply could not overcome this cordiality at that time. In the late summer and early fall of 1856, several observers noted the opposition party in San Bernardino beginning to break up. It looked like some of the least desperate were trying to patch up their differences with the church leaders. The entire anti-Mormon movement might well have died in California at that point had it not received outside impetus for rejuvenation. One of the first factors commencing the erosion of cordiality reflected in the newspapers of the state was the establishment of a rather assertive Mormon newspaper at San Francisco, the Western Standard, edited by the faithful future church leader, George Q. Cannon. Begun in early 1856 expressly to, quote, "correct misrepresentation by adopting self-representation," the paper began by openly defending plural marriage. The Daily Alta California, until then completely supportive of Mormon efforts in the state, noticed the first issue of the Mormon Journal and said that it starts off quite freely in relation to polygamy, which doctrine we presume the people of California do not at present feel quite inclined to endorse. The Alta reprinted a fair selection of its lead columns to give readers a flavor of how Cannon was seeking to defend the unusual marriage arrangement that the infant Republican Party would later that year link with slavery as the, quote, "twin relics of barbarism." Over the ensuing months, as Cannon continued to defend plural marriage, the editorial tone of the Alta, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Bulletin, along with the Los Angeles Star, and several other papers perhaps, changed markedly on Mormon subjects. Another factor in rekindling hopes among opposition and generating some negative feeling among Californians in general was the so-called Mormon Reformation, reaching its peak in late 1856. Church leaders and critics had both perceived considerable backsliding among the Utah Latter-day Saints, with much talk of the disaffected leaving the area the next spring. This had been largely impossible in 1853 during the so-called Walker War because of military discipline, and in the next 2 years there's famine and poor harvests and people couldn't afford to leave. Each Mormon congregation had home missionaries appointed to catechize adult church members to determine just how widespread the perceived spiritual weakness was. Thus were uncovered backsliders of varying degrees of deficiency of proper dedication to the cause. Because of much bitterness and suffering that had been attributed to apostates in the tragic earlier history of the church, Latter-day Saint leaders and the general membership considered such people to be dangerous enemies, not to be tolerated within their midst. Some such persons, including 10 families of recent English converts, were already planning what they considered their escape from Mormondom. But others, particularly those isolated within some of the communities more intolerant of such people, were undoubtedly in real danger. This was the case with William Parrish and his adult son Beatson, who found Springville neighbors not only angered at their apostasy, but also allegedly unwilling to allow the family to depart in peace for California as they'd so long desired. When they sought to steal away in the night, they were killed by assailants, never apprehended. This horrible event was fully detailed in the California press, particularly the Los Angeles Star, under the misleading headline, Another Massacre in Utah. A month earlier, there had been a small party of four men camped on the Santa Clara River on the trail to Southern California, and as they were camped, they were fired upon from the darkness. And three of the number, there was a Gentile named Colonel Peltrell, a surveyor, and a Mormon who allegedly was escaping from the church and his wife, a guy named John Tobin, and several others. Three of them were wounded. And the investigators determined that it was not Indians who had attacked, so presumably they thought it was Mormons. No one was killed, so when the Springville things called the other massacre, that's misleading, but at the time, probably few cared about such details. Later in the summer, the San Francisco Bulletin warned that the fanaticism generated in Mormondom by the Reformation threatened unbelievers. The editorial stated, quote, "Certain it is that those who knew themselves to be obnoxious to the elders believed they were especially pointed at, and the opinion was generally entertained that when the black sheep were thus set apart, a general massacre would ensue in the settlement, and those who attempted to escape would be attacked by Indians or otherwise cut off." The newspaper writer mentioned the Peltrell and Parrish shootings as fitting this pattern. These comments were disseminated a month before the Mountain Meadows Massacre, which was the culminating tragedy in the alienation of Pacific Coast Latter-day Saints from most Californians. Just over a year before that, the San Francisco Alta California anticipated future anti-Mormon conflicts. After tracing the phenomenal growth of the church empire in Utah, the editor warned, quote, "The Mormons have now become a powerful and promised to become to be somewhat of a troublesome element in the United States," end quote. He was referring partly to their apparent disinclination or their apparent inclination to dictate as to what officers of the federal government they choose to have reside among them. The other concern was that Latter-day Saints were presumably a military people, asserting that Salt Lake City probably had more thoroughly drilled soldiers than there were in any city in the United States. It was true that after the previous bitter experiences in Missouri and Illinois, the Mormon militia did maintain a position of readiness, although later events would call into question just how well prepared such men were for actual armed confrontation. More importantly, the San Francisco newspaper undoubtedly raised consciousness concerning the possible threat, mentioning that the church settlement at San Bernardino was growing large and was in constant contact with the Utah Church Center. The editorial concluded that the Mormons were, quote, "assuming a bold and rather defiant and dictatorial air in their dealings with the general government," end quote, and that the situation bore close scrutiny to prevent problems from getting out of hand. Similar statements were repeated thereafter in subsequent issues of the California Press. George Q. Cannon, answering some allegations in the editorials, one of them entitled "The Knotty Question of Utah," he quoted from the San Francisco Bulletin correspondent to the nation's capital, who stated, "One of the most troublesome questions now presenting itself to the new James Buchanan administration is that of the governorship of Utah. The dispatch predicted, it's perfectly clear that if the federal government attempts to enforce its power in Utah, there will be armed resistance by Brigham Young. The Western Standard not only denied Utah citizens would resort to violence to oppose removing the territorial governor, but went on to argue that there was no need for such replacement, since Brigham Young was not only discharging the governmental duties well, but was the unanimous choice of the people to continue in that office. Cannon alleged that Young and his followers had been atrociously misrepresented by the press, and they'd begun to fear a monster they'd created themselves, when in fact there was no cause for apprehension. Yet before the end of May 1857, reports concerning the Utah situation appeared to bear out the earlier predictions. The Los Angeles Star drew on accounts from Eastern newspapers to detail the misdeeds of Brigham Young's regime, as alleged by W.W. Drummond, who briefly served as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Utah Territory, but had promptly departed. In his widely publicized letter of resignation to the U.S. Attorney General, he outlined a substantial list of charges, including that no law of Congress was by the Utah Mormons considered binding in any manner. But the church members were oath-bound to follow the dictates of President Young. Federal officials in Utah, the report said, were daily compelled to hear the form of the American government traduced and individual officials slandered. Among the most alarming of Drummond's accusations was that some records and papers of his court had been destroyed by order of the church with direct knowledge and approbation of Governor B. Young. Besides these major offenses against the government, the former body of men set apart by special order of the church to take both the lives and property of persons who may question the authority of the church. From the same incoming Eastern newspapers from which the Star garnered details of Judge Drummond's charges, Los Angeles newspaper men also gleaned items indicating that the War Department had issued orders sending a large body of troops westward. The California writers correctly surmised that these were not to be used to check the persistent unrest in Kansas or to fight Indians, but to offer the federal officers in Utah the backing which Drummond had appealed, for which he had appealed. Within a month, the same newspaper men added that a man named Cumming had accepted appointment as governor of Utah and was on his way west, presumably with the support of the army. Thus, through regional newspapers, San Bernardino Latter-day Saints were informed of the coming of the U.S. Army and a replacement for Brigham Young prior to first notice of these events reaching Utah in late July. As news of the U.S. troop movements toward Utah became one of the foremost news items scrutinized by Californians, Mormon spokesman Cannon was hard-pressed to answer the charges of treason and dispel the reports he considered false. This included predictions of imminent overthrow of Mormon theocracy, which the Western Standard appropriately denied. On May Day, 1857, the editor explained that those who espoused Mormonism understood and expected trouble likely to stem from former members of the church, even more than from outsiders who had never known the truth. There had always been apostates causing trouble. The gospel net brought in everybody, including some who were not strong enough to remain faithful. We can expect trouble from them. He affirmed the movement never would be destroyed, whatever the hopes and actions of its enemies. Later in the summer, the Los Angeles Star became more apprehensive about the possible clash of arms with the U.S. Army. They published a letter, presumably from a recent Southern California resident then in Utah, asking that his Southland property be exchanged for a horse, some firearms, and a sword that might, quote, be a means of saving his life, end quote, before long, indicating the writer, too, anticipated actual fighting. They quoted the letter, which continued, quote, "The United States troops are going to kill us off, but I think they'll smell hell before they accomplish it," end quote. The correspondence concluded saying, quote, "There was nobody scared in Utah that he knew of, for they think the sooner the soldiers come, the better," end quote. The Star editor took the reasonable position that the government of the Utah Territory needed to be administered with consummate prudence and fairness, while the supremacy of the federal laws was fully maintained. He also affirmed hope that the obstinate fatuity of these poor people, meaning the misled Mormons, would not embroil them in a contest with the United States, which he predicted could only result in their annihilation. In the ensuing week, upon receipt of verbatim transcripts of seemingly inflammatory sermons delivered by Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball, published in the Deseret News of August 5, 1857, the Star editor, and undoubtedly many of his readers, changed their minds. While the tragic experiences in Missouri and Illinois gave the church authorities legitimate reason to arouse their brethren to defend their homes and families, many outside readers, including those in California, concluded the speeches to be incitement to insurrection and treason. The Star editor concluded, "A strong effort was being made to imbue the people of Utah with a spirit of hatred and defiance to their brethren throughout the nation," end quote. The speeches quoted included a statement calling the government troops and officials accompanying them devils and their imps, coming forth from the jaws of hell. Elsewhere, Kimball was cited as saying, "The devil shall have full possession of every man and woman that raises the tongue to sympathize with those poor curses, sent presumably to destroy them, but as outsiders perceived it, simply to uphold the laws of the land." Another Brigham Young utterance, quote, "But woe to that man that comes here to interfere with my affairs," end quote. Seemingly a direct threat to the gubernatorial appointee, Alfred L. Cumming of Georgia, duly designated to replace Young after he had served as in the gubernatorial office for some 8 years. Publication of what the Star termed thundering anathemas could have no other effect than to convince many readers that the Utah Mormons were led by flagrantly intemperate fanatics bent on treasonous resistance to the legitimate authority of the United States government. Few Americans at any time could hold much sympathy with such views. The San Francisco Alta California later reprinted the same speeches and agreed with the Star conclusions, saying the rhetoric shows how incensed the Mormons are on account of real and fancied wrongs against our government and our people. The Northern California newspaper warned that the whole tenor of the Mormon exhortations and sermons at Salt Lake at the present time is one of defiance and violent threats against our government and our people, which the editor presumed his readers could not be inclined to tolerate. At about that time, Brigham Young expressed dismay over the excitement toward him and his people he implied had been artificially generated by priests, politicians, and editors. The highest church leader was aware, mainly through the persistent urging of the Utah Territory delegate to Congress, John M. Bernheisel, of the need to relieve, quote, enmity to the Mormons in the minds of the people of the nation at large by being quiet a while, meaning avoid untoward public utterances. Yet if he and his closest associates exercised any restraint in their public comments during the ensuing months, it's hardly noticeable, because those remarks invariably reprinted in the Deseret News, at least in California, markedly exacerbated public feeling toward the church leaders and indirectly toward their followers. Assemblyman Jefferson Hunt from San Bernardino, accustomed to widespread cordiality toward himself and his constituents, reported in August, "The prejudice against Utah is very great." Similarly, the San Bernardino state clerk, Richard Hopkins, observed, quote, that there does not appear to be much feeling against us at San Bernardino at present, but Utah and the Mormons are creating a stir throughout the world, end quote. And linking this hostility to the California Latter-day Saints would soon occur with amazing promptness. Added to the seemingly incessant flood of negative news items from Utah published in the California press, there were, if anything, more lurid accounts brought personally into the state by lapsed Mormon immigrants who often claim to have successfully fled from the territory at the peril of their lives. Of these, San Bernardino State President William J. Cox complained to Brigham Young that while some church opponents had left his area, their places were filled by fresh recruits from Utah who have horrible things to tell about what is being done in Utah by the church authorities. He claimed such reports had no effect on the faithful, but they did on occasion help shake the faith of some weaker local church members, while the apostates were reported to rejoice a great deal at the added ammunition for their verbal onslaught on Mormondom. Similarly, late in 1857, the Alta California observed that large proportions of our new population in the last year are those who have fled from Salt Lake, almost every one of whom has a tale of escape. Despite reports circulated in their midst, the practicing Latter-day Saint majority in San Bernardino and the Bay Area yet had little cause for apprehension that such reports would in any meaningful way affect them. Such things were expected from the admittedly growing number of dissidents in their midst, but they had the assurance that the faithful always had such opposition, and it was to be expected if not welcomed. The apostate Mormon faction in the San Bernardino area had essentially given up on their efforts to arouse outside support to perhaps eliminate those loyal to the church from the region, with the resultant financial and political benefits accruing to those remaining. But as one correspondent explained to the absent former leader Amasa Lyman, who had left for a mission by then, no sooner did the mail arrive, bringing the appalling news of a massive murder of Gentile immigrants in Utah, the Mountain Meadows Massacre, then the anti-Mormons were on the tiptoe of efforts to generate antagonism toward the San Bernardino opponents. This time, they enjoyed almost total success. During September of 1857, amidst reports of the United States Army approaching Utah, and also the highest pitch of fervor generated by the church-wide Mormon Reformation, a horrible massacre occurred at Mountain Meadows on the southwest rim of the Great Basin, the most popular resting place on the immigrant trail to Southern California. Utah Indians, assisted by some aroused Mormon citizens, annihilated an entire company of about 140 pioneers, reportedly from Missouri, but actually from Arkansas, except for 17 of the youngest children. This was not only one of the greatest tragedies in the history of the American West, but the event that ultimately led to the demise of the Mormon community at San Bernardino. The initial notice of the so-called rumored massacre on the trail, published in California in the Los Angeles Star the first week of October, was eagerly rushed from San Bernardino to the city by the Mormon opponent John Brown. It stated that 25 families comprising some 95 individuals had been cruelly murdered, and that only the younger children had been spared. Brown asserted that most in San Bernardino believed the report, but the Star expressed reluctance to give credence to it until further information was available. Additional details were forthcoming the following issue, which reported that, in fact, over 100 had been killed at Mountain Meadows. At that time, the newspaper concluded it was the foulest massacre ever perpetrated on the route and called loudly for active interposition of the government, demanding, in addition, that the authorities inflict a terrible retribution on those concerned. As soon as notice of the horrible massacre arrived at San Bernardino, the citizens were there recognized that it was likely to affect them in unfortunate ways. Young Francis Marion Lyman confided to his father, "There's considerable sentiment in this place in Los Angeles on account of the murder of that company of immigrants at the Mountain Meadows. A ghastly scene he had in fact just passed at night and would never forget." Continuing, he observed that their enemies lay it to the Mormons, which he assumed was to be expected. The young man then predicted that he would not be surprised if it raised a beef with us in California. Similarly, Clerk Hopkins stated the Rachabites will create an influence against the saints as it will be attributed to them. And President Cox confided essentially the same thing to Brigham Young, saying the apostates were doing all they can to make the citizens believe that the Mormons were accessory to the murder. He then predicted that such reports, no doubt, will give us some trouble at this place. The focal point of public outrage over the massacre was a citizens' meeting held at a circus pavilion near the Los Angeles Plaza. There, the critical feature of the proceedings was a written statement by two immigrants who were traveling through southern Utah just a few days behind the ill-fated Fancher party, George Powers from Arkansas and P.M. Warren of New York. Their depositions dictated at to the Los Angeles Star correspondent W.A. Wallace were essentially accurate in their details. Both accounts first noted the hostile mood of both Mormons and Indians, not only because of the invading army, which they both expected to fight, but toward travelers, to whom they refused to sell supplies. Certainly, the most significant part of the testimony, so far as the San Bernardino was concerned, was Powers' report of the reaction to the news of the massacre he perceived among citizens there. He recounted that while one Mormon traveling companion, Sidney Tanner, appeared to deeply regret the affair, the other, William Matthews, rejoiced greatly at the massacre and considered it a beginning of a long-delayed vengeance, presumably against the perpetrators of crimes against the Mormons in Missouri 2 decades before. The witness also stated that while at San Bernardino, he had heard many people express gratification at the massacre, specifically mentioning Jefferson Hunt, who was quoted as saying, "The hand of the Lord was in it. Whether done by whites or redskins, it was right. The prophecies concerning Missouri were being fulfilled." When the Alta California published first notice of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, it also editorialized, "We were prepared to expect such deeds and more of them, because everyone who comes from Salt Lake repeats the imprecations which were breathed out against presumed enemies of the church." The next month, the paper further denounced the tenor of the speeches of church leaders, the church leaders continued to deliver, specifically contending of Brigham Young, quote, "There is a vein of ferocious denunciation of Americans running through those discourses that chills the blood, and taken in connection with the recent massacres and outrages, clearly establishes not only his complicity in them, but his determination to destroy all that comes in his power." The editor concluded that a true civil war then existed, a war of religious fanaticism. There is no doubt that many readers agreed, and that Californians in general were truly alarmed over recent developments in Utah. But until these comments in the Alta California in mid-November, there was no linking of San Francisco Bay Area in that area by the newspapers to this escalating ill feeling. However, in related comments in the same newspaper page, one of the writers significantly divulged the source of that link between correspondence with the Independent Party in San Bernardino. The persistent Rachabites not only convinced the paper managers to adopt their idea of the existence of civil war, but also the policy of treating the saints in the region as traitors. It was through these efforts, capitalizing on the natural revulsion to Mountain Meadows Massacre, that the Southern Californian anti-Mormons accomplished their purpose of channeling hostility throughout the state toward Latter-day Saints residing there, as well as the few who yet remain scattered throughout the Bay Area and further north. Within 6 months after the Mountain Meadows Massacre, virtually all committed Latter-day Saints had abandoned California for Utah. Terrible as that tragedy was, had that been the only negative incident laid to the Mormons during the period, it would have probably remained safe for those who wished to remain in the Golden State. However, with the rather incessant stream of negative news items published in the California press during the year preceding the culminating event, most church members realized that heeding the advice of their leaders to gather back to the safety of the mountains was their only viable course. Thank you.
Our respondent's body is willing, but his voice is unwilling, and so his remarks will be read by his wife, Dory.
Reportedly, the only one that can read is writing.
That's very true. I'm probably one of the very few who can read his writing. Being a native Californian, I've always worn a badge of pride that California had Mormons before Utah did. Tempering this pride is the knowledge that within 12 years of the landing of the Brooklyn, most faithful California saints had abandoned the Golden State. California did not have a strong Mormon presence for the next 40 years. I have always understood that California was abandoned as part of the overall call to return to Utah during the Utah War. In his interesting paper, Professor Lyman offers a companion view that California Mormons were not only responding to the call to return, they were finding that the host environment was making it impossible to stay. Does the evidence presented by Professor Lyman support this conclusion? In large part, I find that it does. His report of the demise of good feeling toward Mormons in California newspapers certainly supports this conclusion. Less clear, however, is the attitude of the individual Californians toward Mormons both before and after the culminating event, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Of course, such attitudes may not be known or knowable. Surely, techniques of attitudes were not available in 1857. I'm sorry, survey techniques. It is his writing his heart to read. Survey techniques of attitudes were not available in 1857, yet one may wonder what this attitude was, especially if one recalls that a large part of the Californians had passed through Utah on their way to California. These truckers at various times were subject to highway robbery prices or a policy of refusal to trade by the Utah Mormons. One wonders if these Californians maintained a lingering bad taste toward Mormons over these earlier encounters. Indeed, there must have been some perceived negative feeling toward Mormons in California as George Q. Cannon began the Western Standard to correct misrepresentations. I believe that Professor Lyman's paper would have been strengthened had he made the link between the newspaper editorials and the individual attitudes in California. Professor Lyman's paper would have been further strengthened if editorial and individual change of attitude toward Mormons were compared to those editorial views toward other non-mainstream groups in California. Charles Peterson has written that Mormon history has followed an exceptionalist theory, that is, history without regard to the larger social milieu in which it took place. Unfortunately, the larger social milieu is missing from the paper. For example, Professor Lyman writes of the vigilante movement in San Francisco. While Professor Lyman writes that the vigilante movement referred to joined the anti-Mormon movement in San Bernardino, how did the attitudes giving rise to the social movement impact on the growth of anti-Mormonism? Pardon me. Yes, I need the Urim and Thummim. I did make notes, but...
You're doing fine.
So anyway, how did these things impact the growth of anti-Mormonism in California in 1856 and 1857? Such a social content would have added to the paper. He notes that it might be taken care of in the book. My largest quibble with Professor Lyman's paper comes from the statement made in his last paragraph. He states, "Within 6 months of the Mountain Meadow Massacre, virtually all committed Latter-day Saints had abandoned California for Utah. Terrible as that tragedy was, had that been the only negative incident laid to the Mormons during that period, it would probably have remained safe for those who wished to remain in the Golden State." This statement assumes that the Mountain Meadows Massacre occurred in a vacuum. However, the massacre at Mountain Meadows took place because of these earlier precipitating events, the Reformation and the march of U.S. troops. The march probably would not have taken place without Judge Drummond's reports of his tenure in Utah. These were the same things which caused negative publicity toward Mormons in California. So to say that had Mountain Meadow Massacre been the only negative and attributable event attributable to Mormons is putting the horse before the cart. These quibbles are just that, quibbles. More important, Professor Lyman has added an important piece to the puzzle of the abandonment of California by Mormons for a 40-year period. For this insight, he is to be commended. We look forward to his larger book on San Bernardino.
going to say thank you for your input and thank you very much for your presentation. And obviously that lends itself right away to Dr. Lyman responding to the critique. And we'll do that before the question and answer period.
Thanks, Jen.
And thanks for the comments. Good comments. On the first one, it would be great to have some individual insights into attitudes toward the Mormons. Unfortunately, the newspapers are all we have. They don't necessarily reflect accurately individual opinions. It's amazing how many newspapers California, San Francisco has in the 1850s. Different religions, different languages. There may be as many as 36 newspapers here, most of which have not been preserved. I was fortunate to get a hold of 4 or 5, besides the Western Standard. And they were quite revealing, but they are reflecting editorial opinions that there's no way of knowing how widespread the opinions are. So that is a good comment. The other, about the cart before the horse, I believe that perhaps Brigham goaded the federal officials into making their inflammatory statements, perhaps to generate some discipline and some cohesiveness among the church members. It's a lot easier to unite church members if you've got some persecution. Now, that may seem like a wild idea. Even if he doesn't consciously do it, it's done unconsciously by his defiance of these officials and by the intemperate statements he makes. Even when Dr. Bernheisel is telling him, keep quiet for a while, he can't do it. So, in a very real sense, he brings on this atmosphere, whatever his reasons. Now, my point in the paper is that there's a kind of a year of shocks before Mountain Meadows in the California newspapers. Californians are predisposed to believe the worst concerning Utah Mormons, while not yet believing it concerning California Mormons. But it's fairly easy to link the California Mormons to the Utah Mormons once the massacre occurs. In fact, in the newspapers, if I had gone into more detail, there were probably 4 alleged massacres before Mountain Meadows, as well as those speeches by Heber C. Kimball and Brigham Young. And it just predisposes public opinion to turn against the saints when that horrible event occurs. And all I meant to say was, with just one event, they could have survived it, but with the series of events and the predisposition already to feel negatively toward the Mormons, they couldn't survive it. Thank you.
We do have time for questions and or comments. So does anybody have something in particular to address?
How many left?
There have been several estimates by non-Mormon authors. A very fine University of Redlands professor named George Beatty wrote a book called Heritage of a Valley back in the 1930s, and he estimated 1,000 left. I say San Bernardino was the largest Anglo town in Southern California, and that there were 3,000 Mormons there, lapsed and faithful. I have both the Alta California estimate and another newspaper estimate, plus my own research with the census records of 1860, to argue that it's 2,000 who return, much more than Brigham thought. He thought these people were copping out on the church when they come to California. He thought maybe 20 families would come. 450 people come. And he's so angry when they leave Payson to go to California, he won't even tell them goodbye. In fact, he sends Heber C. Kimball to try and talk some of them out of coming. So he's never very favorable to San Bernardino or Lyman. And that's part of the reason why he encourages them to leave in 1857. Most of the time when you have a war, you send your brethren to fight. You leave the families where it's safe. But 2,000... They had ranches that averaged $5,000 each, assessed valuation. Many of them traded them for a wagon and a team of mules, and maybe some provisions. And some of them, it's just amazing, looking at the diaries, they don't even complain. And this Alta California newspaper sends reporters down to watch, and they say,
These people seem happy to sacrifice, happy to prove to Brigham Young that they're still faithful. So I say 2,000 of the 3,000 go back. The backsliders stay. And the same way up here. There are a few who stay, but it's amazing how many of the lapsed Mormons in the Bay Area and further north have been reactivated by San Bernardino missionaries just before the Great Exodus. So a lot of them, some people who become very prominent in the church, like the Thatcher family, are reactivated and go back to Utah this time. Good question. Other questions? Yes?
These massacres you mentioned
is about the massacres that I referred to. Colonel Peltrow is a Gentile. John Tobin is a Mormon, but he's allegedly escaping from Utah and leaving his wife. So he's subject, according to these myths of Danites, if they're myths, to the discipline of Porter Rockwell and others. And the San Bernardino clerk talks about, hey, Port Rockwell's down here. He's lurking around waiting for a chance to do what somebody else has botched, get rid of Tobin. Never happens. Yes?
Now, the disenchanted members that lived in San Bernardino,
yes,
I guess they lived in peace with the active members?
Semi-peace.
Did they fear for their lives like the
Puritans? That when the San Bernardino colony continues to grow, it's a gathering place for the disaffected from all over Zion. When you think about it, these people have been sent to settle the Muddy River. And according to Chaz Peterson, they're going to be released when they die, which is a long sentence to be sent to these colonies.
Well, the Muddy, it may not have been so long.
Yeah, the Muddy was the worst place you could get sent. Anyway.
Now here was where? That would be.
What?
Where would be the Muddy you're talking
the
about?
Muddy River is in the Overton, Nevada area.
Okay.
Near Lake Mead.
Okay.
Anyway. Anyone who leaves their assignment without permission is considered an abandoner of a mission. So a lot of people just quit and split and go back to Iowa or wherever they came from or go to Oregon, but at least a couple thousand came to California. And these would be considered people who have left the church. But some of them want one foot in and one foot out, like some of us do. They haven't yet decided to leave the church, so they go to San Bernardino. Now, I argue that it depends on how close to the center of town, where Lyman and Rich own the land, the people settle. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the San Bernardino Valley, but the Santa Ana River runs through the middle of it. I argue that the Jack Mormons are across the river. The faithful are on the San Bernardino side. And you can pinpoint how faithful they are in inverse proportion or in proportion to where they live. And the number of Rachabites is growing across the river on the south side, on the riverside side, really. And it's getting larger. And those people won't come back. But most of the people in San Bernardino proper come back to Utah. Sacrifice everything. Just really surprise Brigham, as they want to do. They know he isn't very happy that they came down. And they go back. And they settle a lot of places. And several dozen of them will be the founders of Arizona later. The Mormon colonies in Arizona. Half the ones that came to San Bernardino were southern converts. They're used to warmer climates. Brigham's told them they can live where it's warmer. They believe he's given permission to come to California. And when they come back to Utah, they're the first to volunteer to go to Arizona. Other questions? Yes?
Could you elaborate on the attack itself? Who was involved? How many members?
He's asking about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And that is... Wow. There are Indians, and there are fanatical Cedar City, Iron County Mormons. And I'm not sure anybody knows how many of each. Supposedly the agreement is, if we, the Mormons, don't help the Indians are going to punish us too. I don't know how true that is. There's some good scholarship being done by Larry Coates from Ricks, by Ron Walker from BYU, Linda King Newell. Lots of people are working on it, but not me. It's too tough for me. There's no hint yet that Brigham Young gives any orders, although the anti-Mormons have always tried to prove that. Supposedly, they lure, by lying, the adults out of the circle of wagons. And the agreement says, if you don't have the courage to shoot the person you're walking by, you duck down and the Indians will take care of it. It's a horrible thing. And there's a lot of fanaticism among the Mormons, but you got to remember how much they suffered in Missouri. The Hans Mill Massacre and things like that. And these people coming through Utah supposedly said, I've got the gun that killed Joe Smith. Or they name the oxen Brigham and Joseph and whip them. And all kinds of things like that. Supposedly poison water holes, which is why the Indians are angry. Some of that might be made up.
Just to incite them, right?
Juanita Brooks has written the best thing on it, but there are some things coming out before long that will be better than that. I'm sorry, I've copped out on that because it's not my baby. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I've read that Juanita Brooks' treatise on that, and she indicates that there's really nothing, in her research, she had found nothing that thoroughly documented the fact that there were these pilgrims or pioneers that were going across saying anything against the Mormons. I mean, they were basically from other than Missouri, and they wanted to get to the California. So this is something, from what I understand, that probably fabricated or manufactured by the Mormons to offset the bad publicity they were getting.
The comment was about Sister Brooks's book and the fact that she questions how many of the victims of the Fancher Party were actually Missourians. Larry Coates says none were Missourians, which means very few had any guilt before, if any. My partner on a future book, Linda King Newell, her family was in the Fancher Party, and they dropped out in Utah just before the massacre. She's from Fillmore and from Paiute County, and so she's very interested because her family would have been, she would never have come into existence. Yes? Juanita Brooks was a wonderful lady. And an honest lady who believed she needed to tell a story. She believed it was a mission.
And there were these rumors about the Missouri Wildcats.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently they've been agitating the Indians, getting them ready to fight against the army with the Mormons. And the Indians had tried to raid the train and gotten two or three of their number killed. And that's why they came to the Mormons to say, now look, you got to assist us or else.
Those stories about the Missourians inciting the Indians may be part of what someone alleged is stories made up to justify the massacre. Some of it may get mixed up with 1853 incidents that led to the Gunnison Massacre, Captain John W. Gunnison. Ammon, one of the Indian chiefs in Beaver, tells these witnesses who were in this rally at Los Angeles that there were no Indians killed, there were no Indians poisoned. That story is not totally straight yet. And
there were lots of people going through.
Oh, there were huge numbers going through.
What triggered the massacre of this particular company?
Some people would say the gold they're carrying and the livestock. Some would say it's just before Johnston's army gets to Utah, and it's the peak of that Mormon Reformation. George A. Smith has just been speaking in Iron County, and his speeches are pretty fiery. And the people believe that they're doing what the Lord wants done, avenging the death of the prophet and others. It's really a horrible thing, and it's something the church has never really wanted to acknowledge very much. I grew up never hearing of the doggone thing, and I grew up within 100 miles of it. I went to school in Cedar City a year, never heard about it. I took a church history class, never heard about it. So I was a little angry when I heard about these super secrets that we don't get in seminary. Yes, one more.
I'm surprised you didn't mention part of B. Pratt and his story as one of the things.
That is exactly right. Parley P. Pratt had been murdered in Arkansas just months before. And all of those stories' details are in the Mormon and California press also. Now, supposedly he stole McLean's wife, and he's just getting even, and everybody justifies it. But it's a horrible thing to lose one of your most popular church leaders. So, yes, Arkansas has a little guilt. That's right. Is that it? Yes.
Well, I don't know how it relates with the callback of the Saints from other settlements. For example, the Nevada settlement, Noah, and Las Vegas.
Okay.
Ostensibly happened about the same time.
The question is about the callback of Saints from the Mormon colonies at Genoa, Carson Valley, Las Vegas, and San Bernardino. Now, I've disputed that a lot in my book. The Las Vegas colony has flopped. It's fallen apart. It's dead a year before this Utah war. Genoa, the callback was in process when the Johnston's army was first announced to be on their way to Utah. So those have happened earlier. Now the Genoa Saints are told, bring guns back with you. So they know that there is trouble brewing. And they probably were called back partly to help face the Mormon War. Again, I say that Brigham Young has vocally expressed discontent with the Mormon colony in San Bernardino yearly. From the time it's founded, he doesn't like it. I even allege he's just looking for an excuse to kill that colony that's really flourishing, that has some people that are really faithful. Now, this is pretty wild stuff for some of you, but I can document it in the book. He makes the statement in 1855 to Charles C. Rich, when you get away from the stove, you get cooled off. He says, you can't be a faithful member of the church and be that far from Zion. That's his belief. So you've got to get the saints back around the prophet. Amasa Lyman, heretic that he is, says, you can be faithful wherever you are. He made a speech in 1855 in the Journal of Discourses from the Tabernacle that says, I assume some of you people in Salt Lake are going to hell. And how are we doing in San Bernardino? We're doing as good as you are. That's exactly the opposite of what Brigham is telling him in his letters. No wonder he got kicked out of the church in a couple years. I think San Bernardino would have survived as a flourishing colony. And I would even say this. If it had, the Mormons would have dominated Southern California. The railroad center would have been San Bernardino. It was already outstripping Los Angeles. Look at the missionary work. Look at the influence. Now, I'm not saying he's a fallen prophet. I'm saying he screwed up on that one instance. And that's pretty wild stuff. You got to buy him a book.
Let's thank again then Professor Lyman and John Larson for their presentations.